Thank you for attending today's continuing legal education program. Jamie Field is a marketing guru who operates The Rainmaker. Jamie helps law firms grow by finding ethical solutions to getting new clients and marketing their firms. Jamie attended Temple University School of Law in Philadelphia and has spent almost 30 years helping companies and law firms grow. Today, Jamie presents A Lawyer's Guide to Ethical Networking in a Virtual World. Enjoy!
In 2020, the world turned upside down. In March 2020, the world went into quarantine. Not just the United States, not just Europe, not just Asia, the entire world. And because we were not allowed to go out of our houses unless we were essential workers, all of our in-person networking events, coffee meetings, conferences, lunches, golf events, and happy hours ceased to exist. For many attorneys, the only business development activities they have been doing is attending live networking functions, conferences, or meeting people one-on-one. And when the in-person world was cut off from them because they were required to work from home, many did not know what to do. And so, like many of us who don't know what to do, they did nothing. A study conducted by Accretis, a legal research company owned by Thomson Reuters, about lawyer productivity during the pandemic found that, quote, when it comes to remote working, 77% of standout lawyers say the number one challenge to the firm's bottom line is difficulty in developing business. Even in the best conditions, which these are not, lawyers often struggle to engage in business development conversations with clients. Many say this has been compounded today because lawyers are unable to leverage networking events, working lunches, or other in-person meetings. End quote. But, as you're aware, you cannot slack on your business development if you want to build a book of business. And although there are recent in-person networking events starting to be held, yay, virtual networking will not go away. Earlier in the pandemic, Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, predicted that post-COVID, business travel will be reduced by 50% and office life by 30%. Look, you can't ignore networking if you want to build a book of business or continuing to build relationships with clients, including prospective, current, and former clients, and with referral sources and colleagues. And the pandemic has given us the blessing of being able to do so virtually. But you have to learn how to do it effectively, and you have to learn how to do it ethically. But before we talk about how to network virtually, I'd like to provide you with one of my favorite definitions of networks and networking, because when you truly understand the meaning of these words, when you assimilate the meaning into your life, you will have an easier time becoming a master networker, whether in person or virtually. One of my favorite definitions of a network is from John Nesbitt. You'll see this on slide 4. In his book, Megatrends, written in 1982, he said that networks are people talking to each other, sharing ideas, information, and resources. He also went on to say that networking is a verb, not a noun. The important part is not the network, the finished product, but the process of getting there, the communication that creates the linkages between people and clusters of people. I also want to point out a key word in that definition, sharing. Networking and the networks you build are not one-way streets. You cannot go to your network and ask for help without being willing to offer help as well. And one of the laws that we don't learn when we're in law school is called the law of reciprocity. The law of reciprocity is one of those laws taught by almost every personal development and business development guru out there. It says that people will always try to pay you back for anything that you do to them, for them. And whether this is positive or negative, they will try to pay you back. In a positive sense, it means that whenever you do something nice for another person, you're creating within that person a sense of obligation. And since no one likes to be under an obligation to another, the other person will do everything within their power to free themselves from this sense of obligation by paying you back, and usually by giving you far more than you contributed originally. So think of it like this. Have you ever been taken out to lunch or dinner by someone? Isn't your first thought, next time it's my turn? And when you do, Don't you inevitably take them to a slightly nicer place than you took them? This leads to a sense of obligation for them, and they will then take you to a nicer place, and so on. In fact, the more you can give, the more you will get back. There is a wonderful book by two gentlemen named Bob Berg and John David Mann entitled Go Givers, Sell More. What this book points out is when you give to others without expectation of return, you will find yourself getting so much more than you ever hoped. And you don't always have to give referrals. You can give other things, time, support, information. And while what you may be seeking are referrals, it's important for you not to look for a quid pro quo relationship with everyone in your network. What I mean by that is not everybody is going to be able to refer you a new client, but they can give back in other ways. So let's start off with a really great fact. Networking is a skill. Not everyone is born a natural networker, and there are so many people who are uncomfortable going to social events like networking events, whether it's live and in person or whether it's virtual, and it actually makes them queasy. Remember, you're not alone in this. Understand that the definition of skill is proficiency, facility, and dexterity that is acquired or developed through training and experience. What this means is it's a skill that can be learned. However, the one thing that this definition leaves off is the fact that skills can only be mastered through practice, deliberate, focused practice. Kobe Bryant is considered one of the greatest basketball players of all time. There are stories that have become legendary of how he became the player he was. He used to practice before the team got to the arena for hours, and then he'd practice with the team. And then when the team left, he'd practice some more. He was dedicated to becoming better. Even if you're not a facile networker right now, you can become one by continuing to attend events, meeting others one-on-one, and talking with them on the telephone or on virtual websites and applications. Most people think of networking as big events where there are a lot of people who are handing out business cards to one another in order to create new businesses for their firms. Pardon me. And for many people, the idea of walking into a venue with 25, 50, or 100 or more people with that little white square on their chest which says, "Hi, my name is about as scary as going to a dentist or even nomophobia. By the way, nomophobia is the fear of being without your cell phone. And this includes the fear of losing battery power, reception, or even losing sight of your phone. Okay, and for these people, the thought of logging into a virtual networking event with all of those little squares of people staring back at you from your screen is just as frightening. However, big networking events is really just one of the big misconceptions about networking. You have to think of networking differently. Networking is anytime you meet with another person. Networking is the art and skill of creating relationships and then being able to leverage those relationships into business opportunities. And let me just say this, rainmaking equals relationships. So this can be done via one-on-one, in person, via telephone, via virtual networking platforms, or even through social networks such as LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, etc. It is meeting and creating relationships with other human beings. This means basically that you can network anywhere there are people, including parties with your friends, game nights, your kids' soccer games, or play dates, whenever you're standing in a line. And most importantly, during our time in history right now, it's still virtually. One of the reasons that most people don't like to network is because it may seem opportunistic to them. It feels slimy to them to go into a network and try to get new business. And I would agree, because that's not an effective way to network. What you want to do is to find a way to collaborate with the person you're meeting. As much as you want to know how can they help you, you should be much more focused and much more concerned on how can you help them. Remember, give to get. Find ways to make the relationship just as profitable to them. So now we're on slide 9, and if you'll see on slide 9, there's with this new definition of networking in your head, you have to be mindful of various ethical considerations. The drawbacks of attorney networking, unlike almost any other profession or business person, is that it's fraught with the potentiality of losing a license if you violate the rules of professional conduct. So today we're going to be chatting about the ABA model rules of professional conduct. So whether you're online or off, there are a multiple of RPCs, rules of professional conduct, of which you must be aware while networking. We will be discussing all of the rules listed on this slide. But before we get into that ethical pitfalls that could occur, let's talk about something else that you need to know with regard to networking. Networking should be fun. And we're going to talk about where you can network later, but understand that networking can be done in any business setting or any personal setting. We're actually going to be talking today about attending virtual group networking events, those gatherings on Zoom or Google Meet, Microsoft Teams, and other online platforms where there are a large number of people who are going to help you create business development and help you create relationships. But again, networking should be fun. I always go into a networking event excited because I may meet my new best friend, or I may meet that one person who can turn my entire life or business around, or I may meet somebody whom I can help and do the exact same thing to them. Before we go into the actual networking event, you must understand that networking is an essential and continual activity. You can't go to one networking event, whether in person or virtual, and then proclaim that networking doesn't work because you didn't get any business. Oh, and don't bring your issues into the event. To be brutally honest, strangers don't care. And most of the time, your friends and colleagues don't care either. However, on the flip side, you should care. You should scan the faces of the people on the screen and notice the facial expressions of others. Showing empathy is one of the soft skills that is going to be necessary in the future. What we've had recently is a lot of technology that's taking over certain areas of work that lawyers used to do, for example, document review. But lawyers will never be obsolete. They want people to help them understand what is going on, your clients, that is. And so you've got to develop your soft skills, and one of those soft skills, like communication, like being able to create relationships, is going to be being able to empathize. And empathy is a way to create something called the know, like, and trust equation. Bob Berg, the gentleman who I spoke about before, who wrote the book Go Givers, Sell More, wrote another book called Go Givers. And in it, he quotes the famous phrase, or he actually developed the famous phrase saying, with all things being equal, people do business with people they know, like, and trust. And you'll hear me say that a lot today. And while networking should be fun, it is still, after all, work. That's why it's called net work. I know, bad joke. It's going to be time-consuming, and in a world that is currently based on instant gratification, you have to slow down and understand that rainmaking is about creating relationships. Yes, I've said this before, and you'll probably hear it again and again during this presentation, but it is so important for you to know, because networking is one of those ways of creating these relationships. Please stop committing random acts of networking. What I mean by that is you have to be strategic about what you want to achieve when you are networking. And while that sounds a bit mercenary, it's not meant to be. There are only so many hours in a day. There are so many places where you can meet people both on and offline, and there are so many different people you can meet. You need to find out where your ideal clients and your ideal referral sources are hanging out and meet them there. And again, this is whether it's online or off. It also means that you need to know who your ideal clients are. You cannot be all things to all people. And concentrating your practice on a specific area or niche is going to help you figure out where your ideal clients are congregating online. You also need to find out where your strategic referral partners are and meet them there as well. A strategic referral partner is a person who works with or for the clients you want to obtain. For example, if you're a real estate attorney, you would like to real estate with, you'd like to network with real estate agents, accountants, maybe interior decorators or designers, furniture dealers, etc. Think outside the box. These are the people that are going to buy, these are the people that the, who are going to buy real estate are going to be talking to before and after and during the purchase. Try to meet them. You need to focus your business networking on the places where they are and not just random online locations. And what I'm talking about here is specifically going to virtual networking events. So let's talk about these networking events. By the way, these include virtual conventions and trade shows as well. Since the pandemic began, many of the conferences and trade shows that you used to attend live are now being conducted online. And in most instances, the organizers of these conferences and trade shows have set up a location where you can meet the other online attendees. In addition, many individuals, associations, and organizations have taken the bull by the horn and are holding networking events that might have been live in the past. And now there are many different platforms like Google Meet, I should say, Microsoft Teams, WebEx, Skype, GoToMeeting, Tayo, Remo, and a plethora of other platforms that keep popping up upon which these meetings can be held. And one of the most positive aspects of each of these platforms being designed is that they are so easy to use. So even if you're not the most technologically savvy individual, getting on and using these platforms and apps shouldn't be that difficult. And a quick pro tip, if you aren't sure how to use a specific platform, then Google it. Go to their website and download the instructions. Yeah, I know. It's obvious. But you'd be surprised at how many people just try to wing it when it would be so much easier if they read the manual. All right. On slide 12, we're going to talk about the places where you can find an event where your ideal client or referral sources are. Again, you have to first decide on your ideal client profile. Then you can Google them and find out what they're reading, what websites they're going to, and where they're networking. And you can also find a plethora of events just by searching for them. If you Google virtual networking business events or go to the LinkedIn search bar and search for virtual events, the number of results will astound you. There's also a group called Eventbrite, a website called Eventbrite, and another website called Meetup. Now, if you're not familiar with these sites, Eventbrite describes himself as a global platform that allows anybody to create, share, find, and attend events that fuel their passions. And Meetup is a place where people who have similar interests and or hobbies can meet. Previously it was in person, but now it's virtual. Those are places where you can find virtual events. Do you belong to any industry association? And I'm not just talking about bar associations. No matter who your ideal client is, there is probably an association to which they belong. In fact, the easiest way to find them is to search for them. For example, I was chatting with a potential referral source in a one-on-one networking event that we had after doing a virtual meeting, big meeting event, and her ideal clients were surgeons. So I had her type the phrase surgeon associations in a search page. Yeah, I know, it's not grammatically correct, but go with me with this. Did you know that there are more industry associations that you could probably imagine with regard to surgery, and it breaks it down into different niches like plastic surgery and hand surgery and so on and so forth. And if you go to those websites where these associations are, many of them have event sections and are holding virtual networking events and conferences that you should be attending to meet your ideal clients. All right, I'm going to assume that most of you or many of you have been on at least one virtual networking event. For expediency purposes, you'll hear me use the term Zoom event, but I do mean that to include all the other platforms that exist. It's just that Zoom is currently the most used platform for these types of meetings. And by the way, I am going to provide a couple of hacks specifically for the Zoom platform, which will make it so much easier for your networking. So, you enter a Zoom networking event where you find your video feed is on a screen with many other people. It's like the opening of a Brady Bunch grid on steroids with all of those faces staring back at you. And for those too young to remember the Brady Bunch, shame on your parents. Best 70s family sitcom ever. P.S., by the way, all of the episodes are currently streaming on Hulu, and if you want to get a glimpse of what life was like in the groovy 70s, feel free to binge the episodes. It is by far and away one of the least stressful things you could watch these days. Okay, back to this. Look, much like going to an in-person networking event, seeing all of these people can be a bit overwhelming, particularly if you consider yourself introverted. Now, I'm not a big fan of the word introverted or extroverted, but that's for another conversation. Just remember, there are others on the Zoom call who feel the exact same way. And when you enter into the main room, you don't have to start talking right away. Follow the lead of the host, and just remember, you're safe. You're in your nice, cozy home or your nice, cozy home office. All right. First Zoom hack on slide 15. The first Zoom hack is to change your view from active speaker view, which means that you are the only person, you only see the person who's speaking, to gallery view, where you can see the entire group of people at once. By the way, if there are more than 49 people attending the meeting, you can scroll to the next page using an arrow button on the left and the right sides of your screen. Also, the first thing you should do is to take a screenshot of the meeting, or multiple screenshots if there are more than 49 people. This gives you a list of the participants who were there because their names are typically listed under their picture. These screenshots are for later use. You can use these to meet the people who you met and the people who you were unable to meet using social media networking, or you have a list of names of the people who you could get in contact, say, on LinkedIn. Sometimes the host of the event will actually provide you with a list of attendees, but rarely nowadays. So just in case, take those screenshots and save it for later. We'll talk about this shortly and how to connect with those people who attended on social media and how to connect with those with whom you didn't get a chance to meet. All right. Page 16 is by far my favorite, one of my favorite Zoom hacks. Sorry, it's page 17. No, page 16. I take that back. This is my favorite Zoom hack ever. Hide your self-view. There is a button which allows you to do this. When I first started attending networking events on Zoom, I would see myself and be incredibly self-conscious about what I looked like. Was I moving my hands too much? Were my facial expressions overwhelming? Was my makeup on correctly? Or was my hair in place? I even found myself voguing. You might as well have called me Madonna because that's what I was doing. I was posing. I mean, literally posing as if I was taking glamour photos, which, by the way, is very unnatural and can cause others to have a very weird and sometimes a negative impression of you. Then somebody, thankfully, early in the pandemic, told me about the hide yourself view option. You can no longer see yourself, but people will still be able to see you. Now, not only did this save my sanity, it actually helped me with the phenomenon known as Zoom fatigue. Zoom fatigue is real, and there are a number of reasons why you feel so exhausted after being in a virtual meeting, after virtual meeting, after virtual meeting. But one of the reasons is that people get so concerned with what they look like, and they're so fixated on making sure they don't look stupid that they're not themselves. Another reason is that video networking events take a tremendous amount of focus. With all of those people on screen, you're constantly scanning the video feeds to notice facial expressions and body language, something that's a little bit easier to do in person. And further, it's not that easy to focus. Most people think they can multitask while they're on an event, read emails, answer texts, but when you lose focus while in the event, it actually comes off as rude. Also, many of you out there have had to deal with family members and pets coming in and out of the room. And if you're on an event that you deem important, this causes tremendous stress. But hiding your self-view, by the way, is one of the ways to eliminate one part of the Zoom fatigue. I am now genuinely and authentically me whenever I'm on a Zoom networking event, whether it's whether it's with one person or anybody else. Oh, and as a pro tip, if you're meeting with somebody in a follow-up one-on-one meeting on another day, or even if you're in a breakout room during the networking event, hiding your self-view makes it feel like you're sitting across a table from the other two people. It just makes it so much nicer. All right, there'll be some other Zoom hacks later on in the event. Okay, so you're on a virtual networking event with many people, and at some point, the host is going to send you into what they call breakout rooms. This is where you can do your networking. It's very difficult to have 40-plus people trying to network at once, and it's, of course, a big factor in the Zoom fatigue. But in my experience, from doing this for the past 18 months of the pandemic, the breakout room usually has no more than 6 people in it, and it makes it so much easier to chat with others on the virtual event. Additionally, in a 1-hour or so networking event, you will be sent to 2 to 4 different breakout rooms where you can meet new people each time. So let's talk about some of the best practices about how to network with those people in the breakout room. First, understand something. Networking should never be about you. It's always about them. So learn to ask questions and practice active listening skills. Most people use their ears to hear. Hearing is a biomechanical attribute that most people with 2 ears can do. However, usually when the other person is speaking, we are often just waiting for our time to be given a chance to respond, whether it's to prove what we know or just to hear ourselves talk. Listening is an actual skill that can be learned, and when used effectively, creates a relationship with the speaker that can morph into business. When you really listen to others, giving them your full awareness, not allowing for any distractions to divert your attention, whether it's in person or online, on a virtual platform, or even on the phone, and you truly understand what they are saying, they will naturally like you and trust that you can help them with your problems. Then, and only after they're done speaking, can you respond to what they're saying. And even then, your responses should be follow-up questions. The more questions you ask, the better you can get to know somebody. The more you get to know the person and what they need, the more likely that they will become a client or a referral source. And another little secret, and this applies to all aspects of your rainmaking, it's not about you. I'm sorry to tell you that, but it's the truth. People, including yourself, are more concerned with what's going on in their own lives rather than in yours. But when you become concerned about what's going on in their life, the person to whom you're speaking, it changes everything. The truth is, we as lawyers are competitive in our own ways. And as such, we have a need to prove to win that we can win. And while this is admirable when you're working for a client, when you're networking, the need to prove you can win sometimes manifests as a me conversation. We've all experienced it, and most of it have done it in the past, and I got to admit, I've been guilty of this, but I'm also hyper aware of this now and notice when other people do it too. For example, you're having a conversation with someone who's telling you about all of the wacky things that have been happening during COVID, and you respond with, oh my gosh, you have no idea what's been happening in my house, and then launch into a diatribe to prove how much weirder your life has been than theirs. It's almost as if you're trying to one-up them, and nobody likes when that happens. Remember, it's not about you. I regularly attend a virtual networking event, which is almost always the same people, and there are 2 attendees that, regardless of the conversation, always make it about themselves. Personally, to me, not only is this truly annoying, but it's making me not want to do business with these people in the future. Yes, you can talk about yourself because you would want others to get to know you, but you should find a way to turn the conversation around to other people in the room. And when you do this, how you do this is you ask as many questions as you possibly can and pay attention. Find out about them and really listen to the answers, then ask follow-up questions. and continue in this manner. Look, regardless of your political affiliations and your feelings about the man, it is said that the reason why Barack Obama was so good at being a politician was because when he was in a room talking to you, regardless of how many people were there, he made you feel like you were the only person and the most important person, even if it was only for 3 minutes of time. He always listened intently. Lately, I've been watching a lot of documentaries during the pandemic about cults and their leaders. Don't judge me. I am fascinated by the fact that really intelligent people can become caught up in these groups, and I wondered why. And what I'm discovering is that most of these leaders, what most of these leaders have in common, besides malignant narcissism, is that they make each and every one of their adherents feel special, or at least when they're trying to get them in the group. Now, I'm not saying you should follow what cult leaders are doing, but if you made every person you speak with feel like they're important, it goes a long way to building that know, like, and trust factor. Another virtual networking hack, by the way, and this is on page 19, just to keep you up to date on the slides, is to look into the camera as often as possible. One difficult aspect of video chatting is making eye contact with the person you're talking to, and of course this contributes to that phenomenon known as Zoom fatigue. Although it feels unnatural, try to look at the camera instead of at the person's face so that it looks like you're trying to make eye contact with them. Now, people are largely forgiving if you're looking at other people in the room, but every so often just glance up to the camera, particularly if you're in a one-on-one group discussion or if you're asking questions of someone. Also, you've got to eliminate all distractions. This means that you close out of everything else. Close out of all of your other computer programs. Turn your phone off. Stop the emailing. Stop everything but being 100% present in your networking event. If you were at an in-person event and someone was standing in a circle of people with whom you were meeting, how rude would you consider it if they pulled out a cell phone and started texting and scrolling their way through their social media feed? By the way, this actually happened to me once upon a time. I was at an in-person networking event where I was standing in a circle of about five people who were all introducing themselves to each other to see how we can find a way to potentially refer business to one another. Just as someone was asking me what I do for a living, a very young guy in the group's text messages went off, and he pulled out his phone and started to read and reply. Well, I am a bit of a drama queen, and I am happy to admit this, so I stopped talking. I crossed my arms, and I tapped my foot, waiting for him to finish. And the guy looked up after he was done texting and said in the snottiest of tones, "What?" I said, "You do realize that you could have excused yourself and taken that text privately. To which, by the way, he replied, and I am not kidding you, "Yeah, I know, but I don't care." Let me ask you a serious question, those who are listening. What do you think the likelihood is that I am ever going to refer business to this guy? If you won't do it in person, if you shouldn't do it in person, if you wouldn't do it in person, then don't do it on a virtual networking event either. Now listen, I understand that sometimes when you are at a networking event, whether virtual or in person, you may have to get a call or a text that you have to take. As I said, in person, you would excuse yourself and walk away from the group. And when you come back, you can apologize. When you're in a virtual networking event, you can and should turn off your microphone and video camera and then do what you have to do. And the reason you're turning off your video camera is that it is distracting to others to see that you're doing other things, like talking on a phone. By the way, as evidenced in some of the stories that we heard during the pandemic out there, please make sure your camera and microphone are turned off. Without mentioning any names, Jeffrey Toobin, we have heard of many people who've done or said something that they shouldn't while they've been on a virtual meeting. Oh, and do yourself a favor. If you need a good laugh, just Google Zoom fails to watch the plethora of some of the most hysterical virtual bloopers out there. Don't worry, by the way, if your pets or your kids jump into the picture while you're in a virtual networking event. We are all living in an unusual way to conduct business these days, and until such time as everybody gets back to work or back to school, most people will be forgiving if you get distracted by what's going on in your house. Hopefully, they don't do anything too embarrassing, and hopefully they have their clothes on. Sorry. I was in a Zoom networking event breakout room when a man's 5-year-old son came over to have some time with his dad. So the dad picked him up and put him on his lap. Then the little boy decided he wanted everybody to know that he knew his ABCs and started singing the song. The dad was mortified, but everybody else in the group, including myself, thought it was adorable, and his dad did the right thing. He excused himself and turned off the microphone and camera and handled the situation. So again, if this or any other distractions from your household come up during virtual meetings, whether a networking event or a one-on-one with a client or even just a networking event, a one-on-one networking event, just excuse yourself and turn off your microphone and video. And again, I say, double check that it's turned off until the situation is rectified. Okay. I don't care whether you are the most self-proclaimed shyest person in the room. The greatest way to avoid having to talk is to ask questions and then listen to the answers. And I'll tell you a really good rainmaking secret. Most people love talking about themselves. So ask them questions and let them do just that. You can start with, what do they do for a living? And who is their ideal client? Ask them, how did they get into the business they're in? Ask them how they liked working from home. Ask them what they're doing for the holidays. Ask them what they did on their last great vacation. Ask them how they're holding up during the pandemic. Ask them anything that you think would be interesting to know about them, and then just listen and follow up with more questions. I often tell the story of how I got my first job out of law school. I wanted to be in the entertainment industry and was introduced by my father's law firm to the chairman of the board of a brand new entertainment company owned by the Jackson family. Yes. The Jackson Five, plus all other members of the family. I went to meet the chairman for an informational interview and asked questions. He spoke for 3 hours, and then, as he was walking me towards the door to leave, he offered me a job as an in-house associate. I never talked about myself. I never talked about my qualifications. Yeah, he had my resume, but I was a graduate from law school. I didn't know anything. All I did was listen intently, ask questions, and then ask appropriate follow-up questions. All right. Now, at some point, you're going to be asked a question. The question will be, what do you do for a living? This is a great time to hone your audio business card. And by the way, this can be used during in-person networking as well. So what is your audio business card? Well, your audio business card is also known as your elevator speech. And it's how you introduce yourself when somebody asks you the question, what do you do for a living? At most, you have a minute or two to convey what you do and what you are seeking. Try to do it in one or two sentences that are interesting and memorable. What usually happens with most attorneys is they say, I'm a lawyer. There are three problems with this. First, you and 1.3 million other people in the United States can say this. Second, what happens when you say you're an attorney is that most people have an idea in their heads, whether it's good or bad, as to what an attorney is if they've never had to use one. While they have friends who are attorneys, many may still think that attorneys are shysters, blood-sucking parasites, money-hungry, and all of those lovely things. They have an idea of what an attorney is, not based on reality, but based on what they've seen in movies or read about in books or heard. So, maybe you narrow it down and you say, I'm a business lawyer. Okay, so you've narrowed it down a little. There are 40,000 registered members of the ABA Business Law Section. And as you may know, not every attorney is a member of the American Bar Association. This means that there's probably at least, if not twice as many attorneys, many, many more attorneys in law in the country practicing business law and you. And it's incredibly vague. I mean, what kind of business lawyer? Do you work with small businesses or giant corporations? Either way, you'll stop a conversation cold because people will already assume they know what you do. The point is, you have to find a way to introduce yourself that answers these questions. Who am I? What do I do? Who are my ideal clients? And what keeps them up at night? And you have to find a way to do this that's memorable using your own personality. One of my clients and I worked on her elevator speech until it was perfected, and it has actually now become her tagline. She says, "I help employers and employees to stop fighting so they can get back to work. I am an employment lawyer." When I'm asked what I do, I always say, "I'm a rainmaking trainer and coach. I teach attorneys marketing and business development skills so they can build big books of business ethically," and the key word is ethically. But by far and away, my favorite elevator speech was my dad's. My father practiced law for more than 56 years, and when he was asked what he did for a living, he used to say, "I render people asunder," which is great because it allows people to ask the next important question. What does that mean? And it keeps the conversation going. So he would usually reply, "You know that part of a marriage ceremony where the officiant says, 'What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder?' Well, I render people asunder. I'm a divorce lawyer." As you can see, your elevator pitch should explain what you can do succinctly, but also leave open the availability for the other person to ask questions. And by the way, no one ever forgot what my father did for a living. All right. You must understand that going to networking events, whether live and in person or virtual, and even networking one-on-one, can trigger many different ethics violations if you're not careful. And we're on page 25 of the handout. First, RPC 1.18, duties to prospective clients. Listen, I have written out the rule fully on the slides, and it determines when a person becomes a prospective client, so I will not actually be reading them to you. But let's parse out some of the topic of this rule and apply it to your networking. So, again, RPC 1.8, duties to prospective clients. Part A says that a person who consults with a lawyer about a possibility of forming a lawyer-client relationship with respect to a matter is a prospective client. Except this leaves a whole lot of interpretation. So, the ABA has written a clarifying comment which says, a person becomes a prospective client by consulting with a lawyer about the possibility of forming a client-lawyer relationship with respect to a matter. Whether communications including written, oral, or electronic communications constitute a consultation depends on the circumstances. For example, a consultation is likely to have occurred if a lawyer, either in person or through the lawyer's advertising in any medium, specifically requests or invites the submission of information about a potential representation without clear and reasonable understandable warnings and cautionary statements that limit the lawyer's obligation, and a person provides information in response. All right. Since many ethical duties and prohibitions depend on the existence of an attorney-client relationship, it's important to define when that relationship starts and how it began. At its most basic, it begins with the reliance by a non-lawyer on the professional skills of a lawyer who is conscious of that reliance and in some fashion manifests an acceptance of responsibility for it. The fact is that this rule is triggered if the prospective client believes that they're going to have an attorney-client relationship and whether they believe the attorney is giving them advice and they rely upon it, whether it's to their benefit or detriment. It's about the prospective client's belief. So let's talk about this in terms of a networking event. When you're on a virtual networking event, you will meet a whole host of people. What sometimes happens is that someone will discover that you are an attorney because you told them that you're an attorney, and they may inevitably say, "Oh, I have an issue that could potentially become a lawsuit," and then they proceed to launch into the facts of the case. If you listen to them and or offer advice based on these facts and they rely on this advice, you could be creating an inadvertent attorney-client relationship. So this means that just sitting there and listening without explicitly saying to them, if I listen to you, this doesn't constitute an attorney-client relationship, and explaining to them that you may not be able to take the case, and you reply to that person, you have inadvertently created that relationship. To avoid this, when a person begins talking about a potential case, you need to politely stop them and say, this is not the best place to discuss this matter. Would you like to continue this conversation tomorrow? And then acquire their contact information and set up a time to chat. Although this may seem extreme, it's honestly not beyond the realm of possibility that you could meet someone who may say, but this attorney told me that, and you can fill in the blank. The second part of this rule that you've got to be mindful of is that even when no client-lawyer relationship ensues, a lawyer who has learned information from a prospective client shall not use or reveal that information. Look, regardless of whether you heard this information from a prospective client in your office, on a telephone call, in a virtual networking event, you are under obligation to keep that information confidential. Understand that confidentiality will adhere to communications between an attorney and a prospective client during conversations or written communications while they are deciding whether or not to form that relationship. It may be tempting at a networking event to tell stories about potential clients who have spoken to you about potential representation, particularly the ones that are a bit out there. They make great stories. Let's be honest. However, in telling those stories, you're violating the second part of this rule. Oh, and the identity of a client, prospective, current, or former, is always confidential information under the ethics rules. Even if you don't mention the name of the client that you are telling a story about, the facts could be such that someone may recognize that person. One of the questions I'm often asked then is, how can I explain to my prospective clients what I do for a living and that I've taken similar cases to the one he or she is asking me about? And I say that, exactly that. You say, I've worked with clients on similar cases in the past, and that's it. The more general you are in describing past cases, the better is going to be, as we will discuss in a few minutes. So, as the third part of this rule pertains to networking, it's paragraph C. A lawyer subject to paragraph B shall not represent a client with interests materially adverse to those prospective clients in the same or substantially related matter if the lawyer received information from the prospective client that could be significantly harmful to that person in the matter, except as provided at paragraph D. If a lawyer is disqualified from representation under this paragraph, no lawyer or in the firm with which the lawyer is associated may knowingly undertake or continue representation in such a matter. Conflicts of interest occur if you are listening to this person and then realize you may be representing somebody else on the other side of the matter. You wouldn't take a case without doing conflicts checks, right? And more importantly, you could be disqualifying yourself and your firm from representing someone in a substantially related matter. Listen, even on occasions when you may be able to answer the question that you are asked, and even if you can do so generally and with the clear understanding that you're not providing direct legal advice or counsel, it's not a good idea to do so. Stop the person. Explain that there are rules that will not allow you to get into this conversation with them here. And then you have two choices. Ask them for their contact information and then contact them, or ask them to contact you. If a prospective client communicates with an attorney in order to see if they might form a relationship, an attorney-client relationship, those communications should not involve the actual giving of legal advice to the prospective client. Because once you provide advice, then the person is no longer a prospective client. They have now become your new client, even if only for that limited time period, and even if you don't sign a retainer agreement. If a person asks you for legal advice and you've given them legal advice they've asked for, then they are your client, whether or not money has changed hands or agreements have been signed. Let's talk about Rule 1.6, confidentiality of information. This rule says a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent. The disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out representation, or the disclosure is permitted. A lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to prevent the inadvertent or unauthorized disclosures of or unauthorized access to information relating to the representation of a client. We don't need to discuss the disclosure exceptions that are in paragraph B of this rule. Just know that there are a number of legal and ethical reasons why you could be allowed to disclose information about your client. But let's talk about this as how it goes to networking. One of the most important obligations of an attorney is the duty to maintain confidentiality of information. But it's a broad duty that relates not only to what is learned directly from the client, but all information related to the representation. And it doesn't matter whether you're using hypotheticals to discuss the case. If there is likelihood that someone will figure out who the client is, then you are breaching this confidentiality. Recently, I was in a networking event with a whole host of attorneys. In one of the breakout rooms, one of the attorneys started to tell us about the types of clients with whom he was working by describing a case on which he is currently working. He gave a lot of detail, but not the client's name. However, the amount of detail he provided could have revealed the client should have anyone in the room had known him or them. This is considered a breach of confidentiality. And once you begin representing a client, as we've seen with 1.18, your respect to prospective clients, you have a duty to maintain client confidentiality. Anytime you say, I have a client who, you could be violating this rule. So let me get back to this example of the Zoom event. So even though every single person at the event is a lawyer, that still does not give you permission to discuss client cases and confidences. Even if the attorney with whom you are speaking is a member of your firm or on the case with you. This is because we live in a world where there are not only smartphones everywhere, but we are now working from home. Many people have virtual home assistants like Google, Alexa, Siri, Ring Home. This means anything can be recorded. Additionally, while you're in a whole room of lawyers, it could be a conflict of interest breach as well. What happens if one of the other attorneys in the group is or has represented the other side? And by the way, somehow we got into the conversation that this fact that he described this practice would be considered a breach of this rule, and unfortunately it did not make the attorney happy when I told him. One of the things that I pride myself in my business is that every attorney I work with knows the ethics of rainmaking, marketing, and business development. They know what they should do and shouldn't do, but I can't make them do it. So That's my little cover my tushy part. Okay. As I said, Rule 1.6C says, a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to prevent the inadvertent or unauthorized disclosure of or unauthorized access to information relating to the representation of a client. An inadvertent or deliberate disclosure of private information can substantially injure your client. It could harm their negotiating position or ability to receive a fair trial. And for you, the attorney, it could cost you a lot more in malpractice trials, sanctions, or even disbarment. Again, you have a duty not to talk about clients in public. However, let's go back to the networking event for a moment. If someone asks you about the cases you are working on while you are networking, you must be very careful. And in fact, it's my suggestion that you refrain from replying. It may be a great story and it may be apropos to the conversation, but discussing clients when at networking events is a violation of this rule. All right, let's go on. Let's talk about Rule 1.7, the conflict of interest rule, current clients. A lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. A concurrent conflict of interest exists if the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client, or there is significant risk that representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, a third person, or by personal interests of the lawyer. Now, there are two parts of this rule that I want to discuss with regard to networking. The first part is that there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibility to another client, And I want to say this, if you're networking, which I still think is one of the best ways to meet people.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is FIT. F-I-T, all lowercase, FIT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is FIT. F-I-T, all lowercase, FIT. Please take a moment and write this down.
And to create relationships, you have to make sure that you don't do this. Look, we used to live in a world where there was a common phrase. We live in a world, I should say, or lived in a world, where there's a common phrase called 6 degrees of separation. And what this idea says is that all people are 6 or fewer social connections away from each other. Now, I proclaim because of the internet, we are only 3 degrees of separation. So the person with whom you are speaking at a networking event could be someone who is related, even just socially, to one of your clients. This is why there are conflict of interest checks in law firms. But while you're networking, it is highly unlikely that you'll be stopping the conversation once you've met someone and say, oh, excuse me, I have to check to see if there's any reason why I can't chat with you. Right? So what do you do at a networking event when you meet somebody? First and foremost, when you're talking to a person, you need to keep the conversation off your cases. Remember rule 1.6? And on general topics. Again, networking events are there to begin creating relationships with people. Relationships are the backbone of rainmaking. We are in a business in which people do not wake up one morning and say, hey, I think I'll hire an attorney just for the fun of it. There is almost always a reason why somebody hires a lawyer. There's an issue that someone has that requires your legal services. This is why networking is important. You need to let people understand to get to know you and your personality. And you need to make them understand the type of work you do and for whom you do it for, but it must be very generalized. What would you do if, when you're speaking to a person at a networking event, you've explained what you do and for whom you work, and then they launch into a fact that they are in the middle of a case just like the ones you handle? If it's an adverse party, this could present a problem. At the moment you realize there is a conflict, you need to stop the person. You need to clarify that you're opposing counsel or in a law firm of the opposing counsel, and that discussing the case with them could jeopardize everything. Then politely walk away. In addition, at the earliest convenience, you'll need to talk to their counsel, and explain that you met their client. While you may not have learned anything, it's important for you to keep the lines of communication open so that a conflicts charge is not brought against you. I, by the way, would also let your client know that you met the opposite client. Even if you don't have an immediate conflict of interest like the one before, you need to stop the person with whom you are networking from providing any information which may cause a violation of this rule. Again, while you're chatting with them, and this goes back to rule 1.6, you need to stop the person and suggest that they contact you at the office or that you will contact them. This allows you to perform a conflicts check. And the conflict check should be formed immediately before you receive any confidential information from a prospective client. By the way, when I say at the office, I do mean at your home office as well. All right, let's talk about the second part of rule 1.7. This rule says that a conflict of interest exists if there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the personal interest of the attorney. We all know that lawyers' own interests should not be permitted to have an adverse effect on a representation of a client. This is because it would be difficult or impossible for a lawyer to provide a client detached advice. And so, a lawyer must consider whether a client's interests conflict with the lawyer's own interests, whether it's personal or business. This relates directly to the lawyer's duty of loyalty to the client. So, what does this mean in terms of networking? Well, there are a few ways that this rule could be triggered. First, if you have other related business interests, you cannot refer clients or potential clients to the enterprise in which you have a business interest unless you disclose the information first. Again, I go back to the fact that you do not know with whom you are networking and what their interests are. You must be careful of the discussions that take place. There's also a part of this that discusses the personal interests of the lawyer, which could cause a potential conflict of interest. Personal interests could be other relationships like friends, family, other business opportunities, and your opinions. Well, we all have our opinions, but sometimes making them known could be a conflict of interest. To use a timely example from most recent history, if you are an election and campaign finance law attorney and you represent candidates, if you publicly make known your preferences, but the candidate is from a different party than the ones that you represent, this could be a conflict of interest. All right. Let's go on to Rule 1.9. Rule 1.9 is your duty to former clients, which says a lawyer who has formally represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter in which the person's interests are materially adverse to the interest of the former client unless the former client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. And the second part says, a lawyer shall not knowingly represent a person in the same or substantially related matter in which a firm with which the lawyer formerly was associated had previously represented the client, whose interests are materially adverse to that person, and about whom the lawyer had acquired information protected by Rules 1.6 and 1.9c that is material to the matter unless the former client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. I keep stressing confirmed in writing because anytime you want to do something with regard to talking about clients, talking about anything else, if you get your clients to say it's okay in writing, then that's great. And by the way, you can actually do this in your retainer agreement or in your agreement when you sign them as clients. All right. But particularly for our conversation, it's Part C we're going to talk about. And Part C says, a lawyer who has formally represented a client in a matter or whose present or former firm has formally represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter use information relating to the representation to the disadvantage of the former client, except as these rules would permit, and when the information has become generally known, or reveal information relating to the representation, except as these rules would permit and require with respect to a client. While it is truly tempting to talk about your old cases in networking events, you have a duty to make sure that you do not reveal any information about your clients that will cause them a disadvantage. And in networking situations, I know there are many attorneys who love discussing their cases after their conclusion. Unfortunately, like I said, unless you get confirmed in writing consent, it's very dangerous to do so. So in Part C, it also says something about being generally known. And on page 42, ABA wrote a formal opinion 479, which gives you the generally known exception. And I will let you read that, but the basics that you have to know is that it's widely recognized. Generally known means that it's widely recognized by the members of the public in a relevant geographical area, or it's widely recognized in the former client's industry, profession, or trade. And this could become widely recognized and generally known as a result of publicity through traditional media sources, newspapers, magazines, radio, etc. It should be treated as generally known if it's been discussed in their professional mediums. Look, after a case is concluded, a lawyer still has substantial duties relating to that former client. As an attorney, you will rarely send out a letter after you concluded saying, we will have no further business with you. First, in doing so, you could lose other business. And second, you could tick off your potential client for no reason. And it's a great way to lose referrals, by the way. So, when does a client become a former client to trigger this rule? Usually a former client is when your law firm or you have no further representation with this client. By the way, this happens when you change law firms or when the client terminates representation and goes to another firm. Now, we don't have to go, we don't have the time to get into the nitty-gritty of the conflict checks for conflict of interest checks, but please understand that part of this rule is that you can't use the information that you obtained in the representation of a client to assist in another, in the representation of another client if you move. All right. One of the things that I want you to think about is just constantly turning the conversation back to the other person. So when they ask you a question, be very, very generic, and then turn the conversation around and ask them questions. And keep asking questions. I keep telling you, it's about them. All right. Next, we're going to page 44. Let's get back to the networking event. And we'll get to more ethics rules shortly. Now that you've established a rapport with the person with whom you are chatting, it's time to decide whether or not they could become a potential referral source or even a client. And the truth is, every person could become a potential referral source because you never know who they know. And of course, everyone could become a potential client barring conflicts of interest that we just discussed. So, when is the best time to ask for their contact information? Well, the best time is anytime and always. If you do not have a pen and paper handy, and you really should, ask them to put their information in the chat feature that each platform has, and then it will allow you to save that chat to your computer. In addition, the pen is very useful because when you're meeting with them one-on-one in these networking groups and these breakout rooms, you can actually take notes about that person. And I also suggest that you put the name of the event and the date on your notes, particularly if you're doing what I've been doing lately, which is going to innumerous numbers of networking events every week. All of this is going to be very useful when you follow up with them. I want to talk about first impressions. We've all heard the phrase, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. Unfortunately, this is very true. So, when you're attending a virtual networking event and even a live networking event, but let's stick with the virtual ones, it's important for you to create a great first impression. And while some of these things may sound like common sense, you would be surprised how many people disregard these. So this means when you get into or log into the event, you have a pleasant expression on your face. Now, I'm not saying you have a fake smile on your face. In fact, that's not an impression you want to create, but how many of us have gotten on an event with a scowl on our face because of a difficult day? As I said before, don't bring it in with you. Be on time. While most networking events are from X to Y time, with virtual networking, many of these hosts will keep to a rather strict schedule. This is because the platforms keep them to a strict schedule. If you arrive late, you are disrupting the flow of the event. Also, dress well. Now, I'm not saying you have to put on a suit and tie for the networking event, but you should look respectable. You are, after all, an attorney. I cannot tell you how many lawyers I've seen who look like they just woke up when they attend these meetings, and maybe some of them have. But to digress slightly, we're all experiencing what I term the Corona coaster. The up one day and down the next. Psychologists have shown that taking the time to do a usual morning routine, showering, putting on makeup, getting dressed, is one of the most helpful ways to stave off some of these low points. And even though I'm usually dressed in a t-shirt and jeans these days, I never start work without showering, doing my hair, putting on my makeup, and a pair of earrings. And it makes me feel better. Okay. You also have to check your background. While many of the platforms will allow you to project a virtual background, some of the systems require that you have a blank wall or green screen behind you to work effectively. And just know that virtual backgrounds sometimes make it look like your body parts are being cut off as you move. So just be aware of that. As I said, almost everyone understands that you may be working from a home office for the first time. And your home office might be your living room, your dining area, or even a bedroom. Just be cognizant of what is behind you. Unmade beds, messy rooms, cluttered tables all actually create an impression of you. Is that the impression that you actually want to make? Oh, and please remove any inappropriate art or sayings on the wall. Ask yourself the following question: would I want a judge or my grandmother to see that? And regardless of whether you're using a laptop or a desktop, make sure that the camera is at eye level. I have seen up too many people's noses, and it's just not attractive. You can use a box to put your computer on. And now for the most important part of networking: follow-up. You may have heard the first rule in real estate is location, location, location. The first rule in networking is follow-up, follow-up, follow-up. Be the proactive one. You have to be the one to reach out and continue to create that relationship, the one that you think may bring in some business. If you wait for them to follow up, chances are many won't. Follow up. You only have about 48 hours before you start becoming a memory to people. By the way, here's where you can reference the notes that you took. Follow up. Even if the person seemingly can't help you directly, you should still try to establish a relationship with that person. You never know who they know. Follow up. Set an appointment to meet with them further to discuss opportunities. Suggest a virtual coffee date or a telephone call. Hey, even nowadays we're starting to get back into the land of the living. You may be able to do an outside coffee date with them. Oh. And this is also where screenshots come in handy. You can use those screenshots or lists of attendees to reach out to everyone. And for those who you actually met, you can say, it was nice to meet you. Let's connect further. And for those who you didn't meet at the event, you can say, we didn't get an opportunity to meet at the event. Can we connect and get to know one another? And one of the ways that you can follow up is to use social media to connect with the people in your virtual networking event. And if we're going to be talking about virtual networking, we've got to talk about how to use social media for networking purposes. We are on page 47. Whether it's LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, or the like, the ability for you to meet people that you may not have met otherwise is extraordinary. Is there someone that you truly want to meet? Find them on social media and see what they're talking about. Jump in, talk with them, respond to comments. Since I don't have a lot of time to talk about how to use each site differently, and they are different and should be used differently, I will tell you some overall generalizations about how to use social media for networking purposes. Look, when you're on social media, you have to understand that there's two types of social media out there: social media marketing and social media networking. It has nothing to do with the site you're using, but the way you're using it. With social media marketing, you're doing all of the talking. You're publishing content, images, videos, ebooks, infographics, white papers, and more, and you're trying to generate engagement with your fans and followers, and ultimately hoping that they interact with you and take an action. That's the marketing of your services, and it is important. It's important to establish yourself as a go-to authority in your practice area and niche. So social media marketing is incredibly important. But with social networking, there needs to be a mix of both talking and listening. If you're joining groups and networks on social media and doing all of the talking, i.e. posting about your brand and tooting your own horn, you're not going to get the type of respect you probably deserve, and you're going to miss out on some great opportunities because you're not listening. And I use the word listening in quotes, but it's the same thing that you'd be doing if you were listening to a person in live and in person or even virtually. Read what they're writing. Get to know them from that. Your social networking goal is to interact, converse, and create conversation. And you can do this by searching conversations and hashtags or begin new conversations. You're looking to find new ways to connect. Realize, by the way, that Social media, like all rainmaking activities, is not a sprint. It is a marathon. This takes time. All right, so let's talk a little bit about some best practices that transcend all of the all of the social media sites that are out there. First you need to do is you need to create your profiles. Please use a professional photo. You are a professional, no selfies. By the way, it doesn't have to be one that was taken by a photographer. If somebody in your family can take a really good picture, you can use that. It's just stay away from selfies. And if you can use a photographer, use a photographer. Almost every social media platform has a profile section, and so you should put some information about what you do for a living. This is where you can use your audio business card. Who you are, what you do, who your ideal client is, and what you can help them with. By the way, I believe you should claim your name and profile on every single media site that is out there, whether you use that site or not, because the fact is that you want to create a brand, and in doing so, you're going to need to keep your name for yourself. There's a great website out there, by the way, called Namecheck, NameCHK.com, and it can tell you if your name has already been taken on a social media site or not. If you have a more common name, find a way to distinguish yourself. For example, like John Smith, maybe you use John Smith Esquire or John C. Smith Esquire, but find a way to distinguish it. And unless it's your own law firm, I caution my clients against using their law firm's name in their social media handle. The main reason why is because you may leave that law firm and now you're stuck with that name because that's how people have come to know you. Some more best practices. All right. You must blog and post consistently. Out of sight equals out of mind. You need to keep your name in front of your niche and your ideal clients as often as possible. It's because when the need for somebody who does what you do arises, your name will come to mind. Create a conversation. Ask questions of your readers and audience. It doesn't mean that they'll answer back or comment, but they'll think about it. And this is how you begin to network online. Learn each site's personalities. You should get to know that each site caters to a particular audience. For example, if you're trying to reach millennials and Gen Z, consider learning how to use TikTok. Business is primarily conducted on LinkedIn. And Facebook is everything. With more than 2.7 billion monthly active users, you can pretty much find anything you want there. Also, use photos and GIFs to create interest because a picture can say 1,000 words. And respond to comments and feedback, even if they're negative. Now, please understand there are ethical rules you'll need to consider when responding to feedback from clients or even criticism, but we can talk about that shortly. Comment on other people's posts is another one to do. You know how nice it is to see a comment on yours? It's the same feeling for the person there, and it could start or continue to build a relationship with that person. Oh, and try to say something more than just nice post. Be erudite without being a know-it-all. Another best practice, write for your audience. You've determined who your ideal clients are, and now determine the things that are keeping them up at night and use your social media and blogs to help them sleep soundly. Oh, and by the way, do not use legalese unless your ideal clients are lawyers themselves. Instead, write in plain English. Use great titles and, again, great visuals. As attorneys, as a gross overgeneralization, we are sometimes boring. So we get used to using the facts and just the facts. Use your creativity to entice your ideal client to read and listen and watch your stuff. Use keywords that your audience would use in their posts. For example, no ordinary human will search for personal injury lawyer. Instead, they will search for accident lawyer, car accident lawyer, dog bite lawyer. No non-legal person will search for matrimonial attorney. They search for divorce, custody. You get the idea. Inject your personality. Be you. Don't try to be something you are not, or you will be found out. Be authentic. Authenticity is probably the most important characteristic. And finally, think before you post. This can't be stressed enough. This is probably the most important point I could possibly make. Think before you post. It's not just the ethics rules you need to be aware of when you post, and we'll discuss some of those that are triggered by social media in a couple moments. It's the fact that people can become offended by what you post. Think before you post. By the way, the other thing you have to do is you have to understand that the privacy rules of each site that you decide to be part of, and I want to mention a first thing about those privacy rules. Those privacy settings online where you can determine who can see your post and who can't is not going to help you. Every time a website changes its terms of service, you will find that you have to reset your privacy settings, and most people don't. And if you don't, well, too bad. Second, those privacy settings do not insulate you from ethics rules that are mandatory that you as an attorney follow. And those terms of service that you didn't read, because nobody reads them except for me. If you did, you would also know that there's no privacy left if you are on or use the internet, or even your cell phone. Now, as I said, I may be the only person who reads all the privacy rules and terms of service, but there's actually a reason for that. And no, it's not because I'm an attorney, because as I said before, I know that many of you are not doing so and reading the fine print, but because of a very inappropriate, thoroughly disgusting, but very hysterical South Park episode that I will never get out of my head called Human Centipede. I'm not going to go into it, but it's based on the horror movie Human Centipede, and it incorporates Steve Jobs. That's all I'll say. Privacy settings are only a panacea to make you think that you are not being seen by the entire world. And while we can talk about cybersecurity all we want, there is no surefire way to protect the information you post. I was actually the victim of identity hacking 3 times in the past 5 years, and while nothing bad came of it, I now have monitoring in place just in case. If you use a computer, the internet, the cloud, you can still be hacked. In fact, actually, my name was hacked because I used a well-known company's website, and I was part of the Equifax breach as well. Fun, fun, fun. Therefore, it is my suggestion that you do something that most people don't do when they are on the internet. Think before you post. Once posted, it really cannot be deleted. I'm sure you've seen some of those celebrities who have foot and mouth disease whose tweet was then deleted. Once it has been posted, somehow, some way, someone always seems to get a screen capture of it, and then it can be used against you. Remember, you're trying to create relationships with others, and you're also building a personal brand that will draw your potential clients and referral sources to you. If it doesn't fit into what you want your personal brand to say, if you wouldn't say it in front of your grandmother, and if you wouldn't say it in front of your boss or managing partner, if you're not the managing partner, then don't post it. What you can control, what you should control, is what you choose to post. Social media can be a great tool. As I said earlier, you can use it to connect with the people you have met while you are on virtual networking events and continue to build that relationship online. But you can also use it to connect with people online and continue to connect offline. Now listen, just as networking is fraught with many ethical pitfalls, and you must be wary of what you're doing when you're trying to create those relationships that will lead to new businesses, so too will social media. These tactics, by the way, as I said before, are not instantaneous. Rarely does someone hire an attorney without a need. So the goal for networking, in fact, the goal for any of your marketing and business development, is to keep yourself on the minds of the people you meet who will contact you when the need arises, or refer you to others when they find somebody who has a need. So let's talk about how the ethics rules apply to your social media networking. Before we do, I will say that you've already got the rules detailed in the previous slides, and I will not be duplicating those slides for the rest of this discussion, but I will provide the rules we haven't covered and discuss those as well. Okay. As we discussed, you can use social media to network with others on the internet, and while you don't have to, you do have to understand how it works. On slide 52, you will see rule 1.1, competence. A lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Competent representation requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. Look, the ABA and almost every single bar association out there has also added something that is on page 53, which is comment number 8. And comment 8 states, to maintain the requisite knowledge and skill, a lawyer should keep abreast of changes in the law and its practice, including the benefits and risks associated with relevant technology. Yes, I'm stressing this. Relevant technology. Engage in the continuing study and education and comply with all continuing legal education requirements to which the lawyer is subject. You need to learn social media because it is relevant technology. It may be needed in order to work with your clients, for example, for discovery purposes. So why not also understand how to use it to enable you to network online with people who could become referral sources or clients? Rule 1.8. We previously discussed Rule 1.8 about when a person becomes a prospective client and how in-person and virtual networking may cause issues. Again, at its most basic, it begins with a person relying on the professional skills of a lawyer. This means that a relationship can be created in the absence of any express agreement or even without money changing hands. And this could be triggered more so on social media. There are many locations on the internet that allow for very quick communications back and forth. It allows for questions to be answered and discussions to be started. There are websites that allow potential clients to contact or pose questions to lawyers, or social networking sites that permit direct interaction between lawyers and potential clients. And this can create confusion about when a lawyer-client relationship has been formed and when the duty to maintain confidences has been created. You know, for example, you may have heard of Avvo, LawHelp, Legal Guru, and a number of other sites out there that actually allow you as an attorney to answer free questions the public poses. But you will also find that people, when they know you're an attorney, will pose questions on any social media site. While this could be great for networking purposes, it could also pose some serious ethical issues. You have to be careful about how you respond. If you answer generically, this does not qualify as rendering legal advice. However, if the question is fact-specific and you respond in kind, you could be characterized as offering personal legal advice to the person who is asking the question, especially if you're responding in a way that is specific to the questioner's individual circumstances. Let me give you an example. If someone posts a question on social media asking, how long does it take to get a divorce? You can answer that question incredibly generically by saying, each state is different, and then providing some information on how long it takes in each state. But if they start asking fact-specific questions regarding their own desire to get a divorce, and you base your answers on those facts, then you could be seen as rendering legal advice, and if that person relies on that advice to their detriment, that's Rule 1.18 violation. Part of how you get around this on social media is that you have a CYA clause. CYA, of course, is the legal term for cover your butt. Absent specific language to the contrary, people who may be inexperienced in using legal services may believe that they can rely on general legal information to solve their problem. For example, Google Esquire. Look, when you're online, please use a disclaimer which says something to the effect of, each case is different and your laws in your state may differ, Please contact an attorney for more information as it pertains to your individual circumstances. In addition, there are conflicts of interest that you've got to make sure are not going to occur when the person to whom you are responding is not somehow conflicted with your current or former client. So before you begin to respond, make sure you do a conflicts check to see if there are any issues. Wait, what? I have to do a conflicts check before going on social media? We all know this isn't going to happen. So one of the very things you need to do is confine your answers to being very, very general, very generic responses. Incidentally, they do not become a prospective client if they use a form on your website to request further information. You will have the ability at that point to check to see if there's any conflicts and you may that you may have prior to offering to be their attorney. So don't stress about the forms on your website. Let's go back to Rule 1.6 and how it applies, confidentiality of information, and how it applies to social media. We have become a world of TMI. Look at your Facebook feed. Do you really care that your friend finished crocheting that blanket or made a loaf of sourdough bread? A lot of these posts can be plain annoying, so while you may see a lot of information about your friends or followers these days, including complaints and celebrations of little things, they don't rise above the level of just plain annoying. However, the courts do care when you decide to write something about your clients or your legal practice. As inadvertent as you mean it to be, the disclosure can occur in a number of ways. The scope of this rule, by the way, goes beyond revealing information that was shared with you by a client in confidence. Even revealing the name of a client, as I said before, or the fact that you represent someone can be a violation of the confidentiality rule. For attorneys who want to promote that they have celebrity clients, this can become an issue. And something that is very confusing to most attorneys, specifically when they're either talking to other potential clients who they'd like to know, if they've done this type of work before, or if they would like to publicize or market their experiences, that could be a problem. So, not only can you not reveal a client's name unless they give you express written consent, you cannot describe the case and the facts if it would be clear who the client you are working with may be. And it doesn't matter if you're revealing information that's already in the public record or a matter of general knowledge, because it's published in a court decision or has been reported in the news, for example. Even in these situations, it is still important for you to get your client's permission to write about it. If you read various law journals, you'll sometimes see an article about a famous person who's involved in a lawsuit. In the article, they may say the name of the attorney representing them. This is a matter of record when the case is filed. However, the smart attorneys know that they can't discuss the case. And you will often see something like the attorney was unavailable for comment or the attorney refused to comment on this case. But many attorneys will not hesitate to write about their case on social media or even their blog without thinking about these consequences. So consider the following violations of this rule on social media as inadvertent as you mean to be. Consider the attorney who posts about his or her day on Facebook by complaining about the case that they've been working on. The lawyer who tweets about a particularly funny comment about a client's product that was made by an adversary's witness at a deposition. Or the lawyer who comments on the jury they selected in that high-profile case. These are all breaches of confidentiality. On LinkedIn, for example, if you connect to a client, this client is now part of your network, and other people in your network can see that they are part of your network. Now, it's okay as long as the client is aware of this rule and how it applies. It's up to them to decide whether they want others to know that you're their attorney. If you're tweeting about a conference settlement, that's a breach. Even posting your current location could be considered a breach of confidentiality. So please consider disabling your location on your phone for that reason. All right. This is getting confusing, and I know it is, but let's consider this example. Two lawyers walk out of court. One just successfully argued a motion for summary judgment that involved creating new precedent. The other was an observer with no ties at all to the other attorney, to the first attorney, or the first attorney's firm. Both pull out their smartphones and post to their favorite social media site. Attorney number one says, "I'm so happy about my glorious win, and I'm so happy for my client," and that's all he writes. And then attorney number two, who had no relationship to the first attorney at all, posts that he just watched the most amazing motion for summary judgment, and then details the entire facts of the trial. The lawyer who argued the motion and posted about it is now in breach of 1.6, attorney number one. But the second attorney is not. Under these circumstances, the first attorney's post, despite being cryptic and not containing much, it still contained information that related to a client's representation. So he violated 1.6, client confidentiality. The second lawyer's post, even though more specific than the first lawyer's post, did not implicate Rule 1.6 because he has no connection to the case. He has no connection to the first lawyer at all. He has no connection to the lawyer's firm. There's no breach of confidentiality in this. By the way, another issue is responding to reviews on social media. Too often when you read a bad review posted about your services, you will feel the need to explain yourself in the response. Unfortunately, this is where many attorneys breach confidentiality rules on the internet. You are allowed to respond to reviews, and you should respond, particularly to the bad ones, but the response must be measured and carefully crafted. In fact, what I usually suggest to my client when a bad review comes from a client, when I am speaking to one of my lawyer clients and they have a bad review that they want to know what to say about them, I always suggest they pick up the phone first and deal with the issue directly. It could be something as simple as the client wanted to be kept in the loop more often, but that you didn't have anything to say, so why bother contacting them? In this instance, you would apologize and acknowledge your mistake and then ask them to revise the review. If they refuse to revise it, you can truthfully respond to the review online by saying, "A call from between the client and me has hopefully rectified the situation." What happens is when you get a bad review, you, as everyone else in the world does, becomes insulted and feels the need to justify their actions. As an attorney, by doing so and revealing facts about your clients or the case, you're violating the confidentiality rules. All right, let's go to slide 57. We're going to discuss how the Rule 1.7, Conflict of Interest, Current Clients, applies to social media. One risk is that a lawyer develops a relationship with the wrong person as a result of social media. As I've mentioned more than once, that's one of the advantages of social media One of the advantages of social media is that it allows us to connect with people we don't know all that well and to get to know them online. And a lawyer may unintentionally develop a relationship with someone who they really don't know, but who has a directly adverse conflict with a current client. The other part of this rule says that a conflict can arise by the personal interest of the attorney. Again, we sometimes have a tendency to write whatever is on our minds on our Facebook pages, on LinkedIn, Twitter, and on blogs. I've said it a couple of times, and will probably say it a couple of more before the end of this program. Think before you post. Listen, you're entitled to your opinions, and you should feel free to post them on your blog and social media sites. I want you to showcase your personality and authenticity. It's what I recommended earlier, and it's because people will be drawn to you as a person. Then you can connect and network with them to create relationships. But the other part of the rule that could be violated is if you do decide to write something that is contradictory to what you do as an attorney or contradictory to your representation of your client. So I talked about this when I mentioned the example of the election and campaign finance attorney. Again, I will say you're entitled to your opinions and should feel free to post on your blog and social media sites. And you are allowed and should be authentic within reason. However, when your opinions run counter to what you do as an attorney, you could be violating this rule. For example, right after every mass shooting in the United States, my Facebook feed is inundated with people posting for and against gun control. Let's say you decide to post your opinion that anyone with guns should be put in jail. That's fine, unless you're a criminal defense attorney or a public defender who defends alleged criminals who use guns in the commissions of their crimes. Then this becomes a conflict of interest to your client. That's what a positional conflict is when they talk about positional conflicts. They're a problem because the client may reasonably believe that the lawyer's representation will be limited by the lawyer's personal interest. All right, we're going to Rule 1.9, which we talked about, the duties to former clients. You know what? It goes on and on and on, but the one thing that I've got to tell you about Rule 1.9 is that if it's not generally known, it should not be discussed. So in order to reveal any information, it's got to be known widely to the members of public or the members of that person's own, call it business and trade areas. So this is where it gets a little sticky when networking with others. If the information has already been published online, particularly on websites that have large numbers of visitors, then that information may qualify as generally known. If the former client or the client's friends are the ones disseminating the information online, then the information found online publications may also qualify as generally known. And then all of this weighs confidentiality that's shared between you and your former client. You can actually post about it yourself. However, if you're the one posting educational information, which I still strongly suggest you do, I suggest you make it as generic as possible. Using examples of former clients in your posts, even if you don't use their names, again, could become problematic, particularly if that person recognizes themselves on the basis of what you wrote down. Now, more importantly than anything else, we're getting to an area that we did not speak about, which are, in addition to worrying about those rules, you have to worry about the advertising rules. So let's chat a little bit about them. Rule 7.1. which is on page 61 of the slides. A lawyer shall not make false or misleading communications about the lawyer or lawyer's services. A communication is false or misleading if it contains a material misrepresentation of fact or law or omits a fact necessary to make the statement considered as a whole not materially misleading. Listen, when you are marketing yourself on or offline, whether you're networking with others on or offline, all communications about your services are governed by Rule 7.1. And while you're using social media, and this includes blogging and videos and any other type of online marketing, 7.1 can be triggered. So how may you ask, is blogging is social media networking? Well, if people have the ability to post comments to your blogs and you have the ability to respond, it's no longer a static article, but actual social media marketing and social media networking. And like any marketing efforts, you can't use grandiose data-driven claims as an ability to obtain particular verdicts. For example, you can't say, I have won every case that I have tried if you've only tried one case. The fact is that a reasonable person could believe that you've tried many, many cases and have won all of them. And while it's true you've won every case you've tried that one case, it's still misleading to the public. And it means that you can't say anything false that can't be backed up. So, for example, you can't say something generic like obtaining the biggest rewards for our clients. There's no objective way to measure this. However, you can say many of our clients have received multiple six-figure settlements as long as you can back that up. So, let's talk a little bit about your website address, your social media handle. You are allowed to have distinctive You are allowed to have distinctive URLs or website addresses, and they can be descriptive of what you do. For example, NewYorkInjuryLawyer.com or NYIPLawyer.com, but you cannot say something like BestIPLawyer.com. Unless your last name is Best, and that's the name of your law firm, that's considered to be misleading because there's no way to prove that you are the best IP lawyer out there. So when you're using social media to network and position yourself as a go-to authority, be cognizant of if it cannot be factually proved, you should not post it. By the way, this also includes your Super Lawyer Awards, your Rising Star Awards, or anything like that. You can't say, I am a super lawyer, because that can't be factually proved. Instead, you must say that you have been selected by Super Lawyers List and include the link to the criteria.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is SLY, S-L-Y, all lowercase, SLY. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is SLY, S-L-Y, all lowercase, SLY. Please take a moment and write this down.
From which you were chosen. Let's talk about Rule 7.2, and we are fast running out of time here, and I apologize. But communication concerning a lawyer's service, and the specific rules are written on slide 64. And they're written on slide 65. But it's the parts on 65 that I want to talk to you most. But let's start with 7.2 says you can use any media or medium to advertise your services. And, of course, this is as long as you don't violate the rules included in 7.1, including 7.1. Part B says of this rule says you cannot pay for referrals. How this works on social media is with both direct and indirect referrals and recommendations and testimonials. After you've met someone on a virtual networking event, you should connect with them one-on-one. But when you are networking with others, you will find that prior to connecting with them, they will go to the internet to learn more about you. And, by the way, you should be doing the same thing, researching the other person to whom you are connecting. I cannot tell you how many times I've surprised a potential referral source or client with the information I know about them just because I looked at it before I had the conversation with them. Now, one of the most discussed topics in lawyer marketing these days is getting testimonials and recommendations from your clients. Because this is when someone searches for your and your name, those reviews will come up. And there are also a number of specific lawyer rating sites. Avvo, Super Lawyers, Martindale Hubbell, Lawyer Ratings with a Z.com, LawyerReviews.com. But let's talk a little bit about testimonials and referrals. Well, While one may think that testimonials and reviews are synonymous, they are not. A testimonial is a solicited comment which you specifically request. You're going to ask your best clients to write something about your services. You cherry pick from whom you would like to obtain the comments, and then you post them to a site where you are in control. But a review, on the other hand, is something you can't control. It's an unprompted comment of your legal services, and it's customarily posted on a third-party site. You should ask your clients for reviews, the ones you can't control. But if they send it to you first to see if it's potential to see it, and you potentially edit it, then it's no longer a review, and it becomes a testimonial. And you are responsible for your testimonials, but you're not responsible for the reviews, the ones you can't control. Excuse me. With regards to those you cannot control, you can respond to those reviews, and you should, whether they're good or bad. But remember, you have to do so that does not breach rules 1.18 for prospective clients, 1.7 for current clients, 1.9 for former clients, or 1.6 for confidentiality. You'll see on slide number 67, some stats on why it's important to get reviews. They lend credibility to what you do as an attorney. And they can get you higher search engine rankings because it's additional content that the search engines love. Also, the feedback can also help you decide how you want to grow your firm by providing information on what your clients want. And they can be very helpful in building trust with potential clients. But you cannot pay your clients to entice them to write testimonials or reviews. And you cannot pay them to do so to be given better ratings when they would not have given you a better rating had they not been a payment. I belong to a number of different online attorney networking groups where I do my online networking. In one of the groups, a lawyer posted a question about how she could get more reviews for their practice. And another lawyer responded that they tell their clients that every time they write a review, they will receive a gift card to Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. When I pointed out, and I did so privately, that this is a violation of the rule, the lawyer jumped down my throat. They claimed it's not a violation because they didn't tell the client what to write, but that attorney is wrong. To use the legal term that is completely overused at this moment, anytime there is a quid pro quo, you give me a referral or recommendation and I will give you something of value in return, like a gift card, this is a violation of this rule. Now, by the way, you are allowed to give nominal gifts, but not as a response to something. That's a quid pro quo. By the way, Part C says you are allowed, Rule 7.2 says you are allowed to say that you or your firm practices in a specific area of law, and you can use those areas of law on your business card or in your social media. But you cannot call yourself a specialist, and you cannot and say you specialize in a certain practice of area, or call yourself an expert and use the word expertise, unless you have a certification from a recognized ABA provider. On page 69, I provide you with a couple of the certifications you can use that are ABA sponsored, and also on page 70, some of the state-sponsored certifications from the different states in the United States. So another ethics rule that you've got to be mindful of when networking events and using social media is 7.3 regarding solicitation of clients. Solicitation or solicit denotes a communication initiated on or behalf of a lawyer or a law firm that is directed to a specific person the lawyer knows or reasonably should know needs legal services in a particular matter and offers to provide or reasonably can be understood as offering to provide legal services for that matter. During your networking events, you are allowed to talk about what you do for a living. Otherwise, what's the point of going to these events? And yes, you are there to create relationships. Yes, you are there to see if you can help others, but you're also there to help meet people who can reasonably become clients or referral sources. But you must understand this definition of solicit that begins to trigger this rule in terms of your networking and social media. And so on page 72, you'll see the rest of Rule 7.2, which says you can't do it if they know, if they've told you they don't want to be solicited. Look, by contacting people at their most vulnerable, for example, and by the way, this rule was originally started to stop and to avoid ambulance chasing. And that's when somebody was in no frame of mind to make an informed decision as to whether to hire you or not. And by contacting people at their most vulnerable, like after a mass tort event, you as the attorney discussing the opportunity to work together can be seen as undue influence. It can be seen as intimidation and overreaching because the person standing in front of you does not have the opportunity to reflect on whether they would like to work with you or not. This is when networking becomes mercenary, and this is a violation of the rules. Now, solicitation is also approaching a potential client proactively and pitching them to hire you. And it applies to any situation where there is in-person, face-to-face, live telephone, or other real-time visual, including virtual networking sites, or auditory person-to-person communication, where the person is subject to direct personal encounter without time for reflection. So let's discuss this in terms of what may happen in a virtual networking event. You could be in a breakout room and someone starts talking about a car accident they just got into and that they have a lot of pain because of it. If you say to that person, give me a call, I can help you with that, believe it or not, you're violating the rule. But this just doesn't apply to personal injury attorneys. If you hear a conversation about an employment situation or a divorce situation, and then you offer your services, you are violating this rule. The rule does not apply to situations where the potential client opens the dialogue themselves, and it doesn't matter what brought them in, but it does specifically apply to person-to-person live contact. By the way, one of the comments to the rule distinctly says the rule does not apply to chat rooms, text messages, or other written communications that recipients may easily disregard. And the rule only applies when a client is under duress. Rule 5.5, the unauthorized practice of law. You'll see that on page 76. And you'll see what the rule says. Listen, it says you can't practice in a jurisdiction that you are not licensed in. Look, because of the internet, we live in a world without borders. The internet and social media has allowed us to connect with people all over the world. And that means a public social media tweet or post can go anywhere. I have been lucky since this pandemic started to network with people from London, Ireland, Canada, all over the world since this began. As a result of the information you post, which could be relied on by somebody in a different jurisdiction in which you don't practice, that could be a violation of 1.18, the duties to prospective clients, and it could create an inadvertent relationship. And it could also violate 5.5 because you don't practice law in the area in which your client, which that prospective client is located. One way to make sure that you are protecting yourself is to use appropriate disclaimers on your social media posts and in your social media networking, and not to discuss legal issues when you're networking. By the way, a quick aside, many law firms are now hiring people who live in areas where they are no longer licensed, where they're not practicing. They're hiring lawyers, and that lawyer may be in a location, but that's not where their license resides. Lawyers are still allowed to practice because of the pandemic. In many states, they've said you can practice and live in a different state where you don't have a current law license, but you cannot represent anybody out in the current state that you're in. You can only represent people in the state in which you are currently barred. All right, that made no sense, but we'll try this. Then there's rule 3.6, which is trial publicity, and you are not allowed to talk to the media about whatever it is you're dealing with trial, because if it has a way of prejudicing an adjudicative proceeding in the matter. Look, what this basically means is not only can't you talk about the trial to the media, but it also means you can't post this stuff on the internet. It's a basic prohibition because client confidentiality, as you know, is the most important thing, and it helps safeguard against conflict of interests, and it's designed to make sure that the client has a fair trial. Listen, we now live in a world where there's a need for new content 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and in fact, the amount of data produced every day is staggering. 2.5 quintillion bytes of information is produced daily. I don't even really know how much that is. And because of this need to fill content, reporters are reaching out to lawyers daily to discuss even the most mundane trials. There is value to having an informed commentary on certain cases, but there is so much misinformation being disseminated. So, if misinformation about your case is disseminated, you then are allowed to discuss the other's case as long as you have absolutely no involvement in that case. This rule applies only to the lawyers who or have been involved in the investigation or litigation of a case and their associates. So, networking with the press is a great way to boost your reputation and to create your legal brand, but Do not respond to any of your own cases. Respond to cases of other people. You'll see that a lot. You'll see lawyers talking about other people's cases. Like I said before, did you ever notice when somebody's discussing a case, it's usually somebody who's not involved in that case? That's the reason why. The final rule we're going to talk about, and we're going to wrap this thing up as quickly as possible, is on page 80, 8.4, misconduct. And I am not going to read it to you, but it's there. But basically what it says is it's easy to violate many rules when using social media and virtual networking for that matter. But because of the ease of creating false profiles or posting misinformation or embellished or inaccurate information, attorneys could find themselves at risk of violating Rule 8.4 while using social media and virtual networking. So pretending to be a client to leave a review is not only a violation of 7.1 as false and misleading marketing, it can also be chalked up as a misconduct violation under Rule 8.4. Or asking others who aren't your clients to write really great reviews. It's a misconduct violation. It's also called astroturfing, by the way, and people can figure out that they're not real. And by the way, pretending to be somebody else to get information about somebody else's, to get information about other people in the litigation, to gather research, for example, on an opponent or their client, is grounds for misconduct and, of course, disbarment. Listen, we're getting to the point where the end is near. I want to talk to you about the networking paradox. Dale Carnegie, in the book I mentioned earlier, How to Win Friends and Influence People, once wrote that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Learn it. I know that sometimes when I'm introduced to someone else, the name goes in one ear and out the other, and this happens to everybody. There's no shame in asking them to say it again. You can even make it a bit of a joke. Oh, if my head wasn't screwed on to my shoulders, I swear it would fall off. Could you repeat your name? And in most virtual networking rooms, you'll be staring at the person's name under their video feed the entire time. So that's not a bad problem. But ask them if they have a preferred nickname. The first thing I do when I meet someone, whether in virtual networking or via social media, whose name could be any type of various nicknames, is to ask what they prefer to be called. For example, you meet a William. Do they want to be William? Will? Billy? Billy? Bill? I don't know. Ask them, and then make sure you use that name. Also, learn how to spell their name. The spelling of my name is not usual. And while I try not to get offended, I have to admit that while it irks me sometimes, because sometimes the people who are spelling my name wrong should be spelling it right because they've met me more than once. And more importantly, they have probably connected with me on social media or in a virtual networking room, and the name and the spelling is right in front of their eyes. Okay, while this may seem trivial, it goes a long way to creating the like part of the know, like, and trust relationship equation. Look, for rainmaking success, you must create relationships. You must create relationships with potential clients. You must create relationships with your current clients because they can become referral sources. You must create relationships with former clients who could also become referral sources or rehire you. And you've got to become and create relationships with referral sources themselves. And nothing creates relationships more than networking, whether one-on-one, in person, in virtual networking events, and on social media. Now, if you have any questions, please feel free to send me an email. On the last page of this handout, you will see a list of everything there with my information as well. And as a thank you for attending this event, if you'd like to experience a complimentary rainmaking coaching session and have 3 or more years of experience under your belt, please send me an email to the address and put the put CLE coaching session in the subject line. I thank you very much for listening. I hope you got a lot out of this. Have a very good day.